is Judy Gerber with a program about the case of the resistance conspiracy defendants, six North American activists accused of conspiracy to affect the foreign and domestic policies of the United States government through violent means. Last fall, I interviewed the six at the D.C. County Jail.
They let Michael Donald Bray, who was convicted of bombing 10 abortion clinics, and three of those clinics were occupied at the time. They sentenced him to 10 years, and he was out. He spent less time serving that sentence than I have spent awaiting trial without bail. And yet, he's out on the street.
A lot of us already have the equivalent of life sentences. Why give us potentially 255 years more among the six of us? It's sort of a political overkill that says the government is so powerful, we can sort of annihilate the political challenge represented by social movements with our sheer power, our ability to repress you. And you're supposed to get that message.
That was Laura Whitehorn and Dr. Alan Berkman, two of the six North American political prisoners facing yet another trial. The six, known as the Resistance Conspiracy Defendants, are charged with conspiracy to affect the foreign and domestic policies of the United States government through violent means. Five of the six are already serving extraordinarily long sentences for convictions relating to their political activities. For example, Susan Rosenberg and Tim Blunk were sentenced to 58 years each for possession of explosives, 16 times the national average. Through interviews with the six, Marilyn Buck, Laura Whitehorn, Susan Rosenberg, Linda Evans, Alan Berkman, and Tim Blunk, it becomes clear that the United States government wants to guarantee that these six anti-imperialists spend the rest of their lives in prison. The government is making examples of them to create fear among people in the progressive movement about the nature of protest. Marilyn Buck.
The case is about wanting to take people who are members of our movement, the Central America movement, the movement for that supports national liberation struggles of Puerto Rico around the world, the black liberation struggle, Native American struggles here at home, and to try to criminalize us, to create a situation where we are disowned by the movement, and to limit what is the nature of protest, what is acceptable in this country. Specifically, we're charged with conspiracy to alter and change the policies of the U.S. government, both foreign and domestic, through use of violent methods against government buildings and property. And besides the conspiracy, we're charged with four bombings, the bombing of the Capitol in 1983, and as well as the bombing of two Navy bases and one Army base, the U.S. War College. These bombings took place in 1983 and 84 here in Washington, D.C. This indictment was brought 3 years after all of us were already in custody, and they had already tried each of us on other related charges that could be drummed up out of the pieces of the arrest.
Laura Whitehorn.
It's not just political because we are political, which is true. It's not just political because the charges are political, which they are. It's also a political decision by the Justice Department to bring it. And it comes directly out of the Reagan-Bush-Meese era. It comes in the context of greater and greater social control and political control and repression. They wanted to, quote, teach a lesson. That's what Jay Stevens, the prosecutor, said when he announced the indictment, that people cannot break the laws of this country, fight the government, and engage in what the government calls terrorism, and what people around the world and us and the movements in this country for social change call fighting for social change and human rights, that you can't get away with that. And the government wants to make sure that especially the young people who are coming up now in the movements, but the movement fighting around AIDS, the movements fighting anti-racism, and particularly the movement fighting around Central America, does not get any ideas in its head that it can actually try to stop U.S. war crimes.
The six defendants have all been political activists since the 60s. Their experience gives them a valuable historical perspective for the movement. As a participant in Students for a Democratic Society, SDS, Linda Evans was first arrested and beaten up by police in a demonstration against the Vietnam War. She was convicted on felony assault charges. In 1985, Evans was arrested as a convicted felon attempting to buy a weapon under a false name. For this, she is doing 35 years in prison, many times the national average. In fact, the federal government's sentencing guidelines are for no more than 24 months for this act. Linda Evans.
I think there are parallels between the struggle against the war in Vietnam and the fight against U.S. intervention in Central America are very striking. Like, there's a real capability for that movement, for the Central America Solidarity Movement, to stop the United States from destroying the revolutionary governments and the revolutionary movements that exist in Central America. But I think there are lessons that need to be drawn and that can be drawn from the experience of the anti-war movement in the 60s to now. All types of tactics had to be employed by the anti-war movement in order to be a strong enough movement to force our government to withdraw. All of the different forms of struggle that we have employed as a movement are legitimate and are important, and that goes from lobbying and writing letters, which is all that some people will do, to protesting, sitting in, doing teach-ins, and of course some of the activities that I've been accused of are armed activities, are political bombings, are propaganda type activities against the war machine and against U.S. war crimes.
Susan Rosenberg has been called the most dangerous woman in America by the government and the media. Since her arrest in 1984, she has been singled out for some of the most severe treatment any political prisoners in the United States have yet seen. Susan Rosenberg.
More and more people in this society who struggle are getting defined as terrorists. In the CISPUS investigation that the FBI did in terms of the Central America Solidarity Movement and people who rose to defend Central America, they called that an anti-terrorist investigation. There are people now who are involved in struggles about the, you know, ecology of our planet, who are involved in anti-nuclear activity, and some of it is very militant activity to try and actually stop the use of nuclear power. Those people are called terrorists, you know, by the government. I've read article after article, and I think the plowshares people, the people involved in trying to stop the missiles, you know, they call Katya Komisarek a terrorist, the woman from California who is doing 5 years for trying to stop a naval star. When anybody lets somebody be defined by the government and accept that definition by the government and not oppose what that means, it's a mistake, because it allows for a broadening of repression in the movements and the society as a whole.
The trial itself has not yet begun, but the resistance conspiracy defendants have been in the courtroom for pretrial motions. Tim Blunk and Alan Berkman describe the atmosphere.
To begin with, surrounding the courtroom, we have a paramilitary show of force that involves helicopters circling the courthouse, snipers on the surrounding rooftops, U.S. Marshals and FBI agents in the flak jackets carrying automatic weapons and shotguns. To get into the courtroom, you pass through, you know, multiple security checks and at least two metal detectors. And then you enter the courtroom and are confronted with a 10-foot high and 3-inch thick plexiglass bulletproof wall that separates the spectators area from the well of the courtroom. And it's not the first time in the entire history of the federal courts that these have been used, although it's the first time in a political case that such a wall has been instituted and introduced into a courtroom. In addition to the wall, we also have surveillance cameras that are positioned aimed at the spectators area and at the defense table. And this is in addition to multiple numbers of U.S. Marshals that are sitting directly behind us at the defense table within the well of the courtroom itself. And I would say probably about half of the audience are FBI agents and armed marshals. So the atmosphere that is created is one of a projection of state power.
What becomes clear is it has nothing to do with criminal justice. You couldn't begin to think you could get a fair trial under those circumstances. And it's clearly designed to portray us as the enemy. It's not a criminal justice case. This is an interest of the state and their enemy. The whole use of the word terrorism in these kind of courtrooms is really designed to say political people like us are just sort of marginal elements, crazed individuals, rather than representing an actual social movement.
Susan Rosenberg spent 18 months in the Lexington Control Unit with political prisoner Sylvia Baraldini and Puerto Rican prisoner of war Alejandrina Torres. When they arrived, the entire unit, the floors, the walls, the metal furniture, everything was painted completely white, which damaged their eyesight. Everything they said or ate was logged in a book. The women had no contact with other prisoners, and only immediate family was allowed to visit. While their treatment did not involve the obvious brutality of beatings and traditionally violent torture, conditions in Lexington had a devastating impact on the women's physical health. The American Civil Liberties Union and Amnesty International condemned Lexington as a psychological torture unit. Progressive organizations and individuals waged a successful campaign to shut Lexington down. Rosenberg talked about the psychological effects of the control unit.
I was in Lexington, in the Lexington High Security Unit, which was an experimental program targeting women political prisoners to psychologically torture us through complete isolation to see what we would do, how we would respond. They wanted to see how people in the United States would respond to that, how the movement would respond to that, and how particular prisoners would respond to that. And they learned a lot from that. We spent 2 years in an underground basement with no social contact of any kind other than with prison, you know, the prison administration and our attorneys, and then eventually immediate family. But it was very clear that as an experiment, there was, you know, the point was to incapacitate us politically, was to cut us off. And they've justified that completely on the basis of us being, quote, terrorists. And it doesn't work, and that's the thing that's so incredible about all of these experiments, because they do it to political prisoners in West Germany and in Britain, who the Irish prisoners, and in Turkish prisoners. One of the United Nations says that one of the hallmarks of the treatment of political prisoners is isolation as a tactic by various governments. And in 90% of the cases that have been looked at and analyzed, and certainly including our own, it doesn't work, because when you get experimented on and you get put in that kind of a situation, the will to struggle against it gets greater. I can speak for every political prisoner in the United States that we all reject the characterization by the government that we are terrorists. And I think that, you know, we are political. We are all deeply political, social, and human people who have been involved in our movement's political and resistance struggles for 15, 10, 20, you know, years. The United States government has to deny the existence of a serious political opposition because they're adamant about putting on a face in the world that there is social peace in the United States.
The six resistance conspiracy defendants are North Americans who have struggled actively in the movement against racism and in support of black liberation. Laura Whitehorn.
All of us come from the anti-racist movement. And so what we're on trial for here is partly for fighting racism, not for talking about it and, you know, which they let you do in this country to a certain point, but for fighting it for years, for being committed to changing it. And when you do that, you become challenging to the government. They want to put the lid on that. They want to squelch that. What's going on today in Bensonhurst, and what's going on, I was just talking to one of the guards when he brought me up. He asked me, why aren't you out on bail? And I said, well, if I were one of the guys who had killed Yusuf Hawkins, I would be out on bail, because they're out on bail. And he said, I guess the things that you're in here for are still going on, huh? And I said, yes, they very much are. And so if people are in the streets angry about racist murders, then they also have an interest in us being able to beat our case.
It is the government's hope that through their attempts at criminalization of political prisoners, they will succeed in isolating the prisoners from the movements from which they emerged. In light of this, every political prisoner has talked about the importance of support, both through their trials and in prison.
In our case, so far, where the most massive support for us has come from has been from the women's and the lesbian and gay press and communities. And I think that that's been very important to us. It's been particularly politically important to all of us, and it's been particularly personally important for me and Linda as lesbians. And the reason that I think that that's true is a couple of things. One is that I think that the women's movement and the gay and lesbian movements have always sort of embraced their own, and more I think that that's true, and I think that's a very important thing for a movement. I don't think you can ever be a serious movement if you don't protect your own people. But I think the main reason that we've gotten that kind of support, and the kind of support that says, I may not agree with everything you've done, I may not agree with everything you say, but we're all part of the same movement and we're fighting the same government, is because I think that those movements are right now very actively involved in a militant and life and death struggle against U.S. imperialism and against the government. And that is particularly true around AIDS, but I think it's true of all of the struggles that women and gay people are waging for our lives at this point in history.
Linda Evans.
Two of us are lesbians, and we're very proud of that fact. It's been an amazing struggle for us to come out as publicly as we have as lesbians in the media, on the radio, being interviewed as lesbians, etc. And certainly in our communities where we worked and did political organizing, we were out as lesbians. But it's a whole different thing to be interviewed and be in the newspapers, etc., as being lesbians.
I think that at this point, as we become criminalized, as homosexuality is against the law and the laws are to be enforced, as women's control over our own bodies is against the law, it's absolutely necessary that we fight that we not just lobby against it, although that's very important. It's important to get the laws changed. But we really, as a lesbian, I really believe that I will never be, quote, legal in this society. I will never be accepted by U.S. society. They need women to be, we used to call women second-class citizens. I think it's much deeper than that. I think that the whole quality of life in this country is threatened by women being full human beings, and by women having full access to our own sexuality and our own creativity and to our own judgment and our own intelligence.
The four of us who are on trial have been fighting for women's liberation ever since we became conscious of our own oppression. And we have struggled in every manner possible to resist both women's oppression and the U.S. government and its war crimes and what it's doing around the world. We are part of the women's liberation movement, and building women's resistance is what will make our movement as a whole much more revolutionary, because we will be challenging some of the male supremacy that has dominated both our movement and certainly our society as a whole for all time.
In my lifetime, I have seen thousands of things change, countries change, nations change, and people change. And I know, for example, in the next number of years that South Africa is going to be free.
and it's going to be run by the black majority of people there. And I take, as an anti-imperialist, you know, incredible amount of strength from all of those things that develop in the world.
Shortly after Nelson Mandela was released from prison on February 11th, I spoke by telephone with Marilyn Buck, who had just received the news of Mandela's release. Mandela's freedom brings attention to political prisoners around the world. I asked Buck what his release meant for political prisoners here.
Nelson Mandela has, as one person, as much role as any one person plays in terms of history and struggle, has been playing an amazingly very important role, not only for liberation struggles, but particularly for political prisoners. I think that his courage and his bravery and what his message is, that political prisoner is not just defined by what you think, but it's defined about by what kind of acts you take in the world. So I think for all of us as political prisoners, we live particularly now in a period where the United States and its cohorts all want to define that political prisoners, if they're going to even admit that there are some, are people who are only prisoners of conscience. And Nelson Mandela says, no, I'm not just a prisoner of conscience. I'm a political prisoner. I was convicted of sabotage. And that's an act against the state. And I think that voice, you know, will resound around the world, because it is a struggle to look at, well, who are political prisoners around the world, and what is it that we're fighting for, and what are the terms of struggle?
I think, on a very personal level, I have felt that it is our task as political prisoners to continue to struggle. And to the degree that we can play a role in fighting for revolutionary change in this country, I think that's what we have to do, whether we're in prison or not. And the only other thing I would add is that the love and support from different people has really helped make a difference. The day that we walked into the basement at Lexington, I was with Alejandrina Torres, and we looked at each other and we said, this is hell, this is Stammheim, this is the white sepulcher, we called it. But I would also say that never for one second did I think that we wouldn't win a major struggle that closed that unit. Part of the reason why was that I feel and I believe that we are beginning to be understood as part of a movement. And so even though I've been in isolation in solitary confinement or small group isolation for, you know, 3.5, almost 4 years, I never felt abandoned. I never felt that I was totally alone, and I think that made a very important and crucial difference. And I have to thank everybody who did anything that they did around some of that stuff, because it really does make a difference.
One of the goals of the government when they imprison political activists is to put such pressure on them that they will denounce their political ideals. Like most of the political prisoners and prisoners of war in this country, the Six have continued to involve themselves in the social movements as best they can from inside. Their desire to beat this case is motivated by a desire to once again be full participants in political movements on the outside.
Certainly there are many more issues today than ever before to struggle around. The government's about to try to make it illegal and a crime against the state for a woman to exercise control over her own body. We need to fight that. The rise of homophobia and of attacks on lesbians and gay men is just going out of sight. We need to fight that. We need to fight racism ever, always, and continuing. We're all community activists and anti-imperialists with 20 years of experience, and we're all completely committed to continuing to fight the government. Otherwise, they wouldn't be putting this case on either. We need to be back in the communities, and we think we could be returned to the communities if there's an active campaign to free political prisoners and to get this indictment dropped.
Alan Berkman.
This indictment was brought for political reasons. It can be dropped as a result of political pressure as well. In fact, there is a part literally of the law that says that the government can ask a judge to dismiss an indictment, quote, in the interest of justice. the United States continues to try to deny that it has political prisoners, tries to deny that it has political trials, has us on trial in a bulletproof courtroom in the middle of Washington, D.C., on charges of trying to change U.S. domestic and foreign policy, but there are no political trials here. You have to understand, it just looks that way. It's very important to expose the fact that there are political prisoners and political trials.
They make political decisions all the time about which cases they pursue. This government, this regime, has made decisions that let Oliver North walk around town after a conviction and never spend a day in jail for the simple reason that Oliver North was pursuing government policies. Why should they lock him up? That would be like locking themselves up. That would be like giving up their strategy to defeat the Nicaraguan Revolution. KKK leader Don Black, same thing. He was convicted of trying to stage an invasion of Dominica to set up an international drug network, and he spent less time in jail on his sentence than we've spent awaiting trial.
Last year, Judge Green, who is presiding over this case, dropped the charges against Rosenberg, Blunk, and Berkman. He ruled that these charges represented double jeopardy, since the three were already convicted on similar charges. The government appealed the judge's decision, but the appeals court refused to overturn it. At this stage, the prosecutor has appealed the court's ruling to the Supreme Court.
We're trying to engage in a campaign to get the indictment dropped. We think there's an opening in the fact that the indictment has already been damaged severely by the judge's decision to drop the charges against Susan, Tim, and Alan, which he was basically had to do by following his own laws. Because they were going to be tried twice for the same offenses. We feel that at this point, if we pursue it more, we can make the government's case completely fall apart. Because the reason we were able to win the motion to dismiss the charges against Susan, Tim, and Alan was because the government overstepped itself in bringing this indictment. They were so anxious to punish people for the Capitol bombing and for revolutionary resistance against the government policies in Central America and in South Africa and within this country, that they drew up too broad an indictment. And at this point, because they did that, we think we can go for broke.
In this period when U.S. policy has been gaining so much support, we have far too few voices in opposition. The political prisoners are integral to building a movement of resistance. We need to tear down the walls of silence and build a wall of resistance.
It's very important that it be exposed that there are political prisoners in this country, that the United States that waltzes around the world criticizing everyone else for human rights violations holds at least 150 political prisoners and prisoners of war from all the different social movements. The New African Black Movement, the Puerto Rican Independence Movement, the Native American Movement, the Mexicano Movement, and the North American Anti-Imperialist Movement. There are people who have taken action against nuclear war and militarization in the prisons of the United States, and that has to be exposed, because unless it's exposed, there's no room for struggle to go beyond a certain point in this country. Because if this is such a great place, if there are no political contradictions, if there are no problems in the society that motivate people to fight and to struggle and to come up against the government, which is why people end up in jail as political prisoners, then what are we fighting for? We're just fighting to change this little thing or that little thing. And ultimately, everything will not change.
It's just an illusion.
This program was produced at WRFG Atlanta by Judy Gerber. For more information on the resistance conspiracy defendants, contact the Emergency Committee for Political Prisoners' Rights, Post Office Box 28191, Washington, D.C., 20038. That's the Emergency Committee for Political Prisoners' Rights, Post Office Box 28191, Washington, D.C., 20038.
For
For more information locally, you can contact Prairie Fire Organizing Committee at Post Office Box 18044, Atlanta, Georgia 30316. That's Prairie Fire Organizing Committee, Post Office Box 18044, Atlanta, Georgia 30316. That's it for Community Forum here today on WRFG in Atlanta. And next week's Community Forum will be hosted by Gary Washington with Labor Forum. Stay tuned now for Born in a Barn.